and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday about lunchtime to explore issues from every angle I can possibly get. Today is a very special Real Talk episode. We're going to be here for an hour. So I want to start with some information for you. According to the ACLU and CNN, despite making up close to 5% of the global population, the U.S. has nearly 25% of the world's prison population. Our incarcerated population has increased 700% since 1970. And though African Americans comprise only about 12% of the total U.S. population, they represent 33% of the federal and state prison populations. One of every three black boys born today can expect to go to prison in his lifetime, compared to one of every 17 white boys, unless things change. On today's Real Talk special, we're spending a full hour on the topic of mass incarceration in the U.S. and the preponderance of black Americans in prison, how we got to this point, and what can be done to correct the inherent injustices in this system that seems to chug along on vestiges of slavery. I am honored to welcome, on Zoom, four area leaders in the effort to reduce our unjust incarceration rates, especially as they affect African Americans. They are Kendrick Washington, Youth Policy Counsel for Washington State's ACLU chapter, Fred Diamondstone, a Seattle lawyer whose 40-year practice has included civil rights, police misconduct, and free speech cases. He has received the Public Justice Award from the Washington State Association for Justice and the Washington State Bar Association's President's Award. Bailey DeYoung, retired island attorney and criminal justice activist, and Janie Starr, a leader for the Vashon Island chapter of SURGE, that's Showing Up for Racial Justice. Welcome to all of you, and thanks so much for sharing some of your precious time on Real Talk. I'd like to hear from each of you. Welcome. Janie.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Bailey. Bailey, you're muted.
Somebody has to do that, right?
Once every That's right.
Looking forward to this.
Great. Kendrick.
I'm glad to be here, eager to chat with you.
And Fred Diamondstone.
Happy to join the conversation.
I want to start with a question to Kendrick. The ACLU's February report on mass incarceration indicates that the incarceration rate of African Americans is five times the rate of white people. Tell us what the ACLU has found are the consequences of this imbalance on individuals, families, and communities.
That's a large question. I think the consequences are multifold. You have the consequences that hit the community most directly in terms of the destruction of the family unit. You know, we constantly hear about how important it is to have fathers at home or both parents at home. And the incarceration rate strikes directly at the heart of the family unit. But what it also does is it helps keep these same communities in poverty. I think particularly in a state like Washington and particularly in a city like King County, where it is so expensive to live, and it is the necessity of a high income or at least a dual family income is so important. When you remove that many people from the community, it strikes right at the heart of the economy, the ability to make money, to raise families, to own black businesses, et cetera. So, you know, in terms of consequences, I would start there.
That's quite a start. Yeah. And as of February, according to your report, Washington State has 19,000 people behind bars. What can you tell us about the state's incarceration rate? Why do you think we're incarcerating more people despite a drop in the violent crime rate?
The United States, not just Washington, the United States has an incarceration problem, and Washington certainly is not an exception. If you're just looking at it from a neutral standpoint, we have too many laws on the books, too many laws that are punishable by incarceration, too many offenses that people are in jail for that they could still be in the community making reparations for. And then, of course, underpinning this all, because you pointed out the disparity yourself, is the undercurrent of racism. While many of these laws are neutral, in application, they aren't being applied evenly, as demonstrated by your numbers. And, you know, any ideas that Black people are more criminal or somehow commit more crimes has been debunked time and time again. And so you can't ignore the fact that race, unfortunately, plays a role. And second to that, poverty plays a role in the criminalization of individuals here in Washington.
Thank you, Kendrick Washington of the ACLU. That brings us to the current unrest around police brutality, particularly over Black people. And Fred Diamondstone, you're among the 50 signers from the Northwest Police Misconduct Attorneys who wrote U.S. congressional representatives in support of the proposed Justice in Policing Act of 2020. First of all, who are the Northwest Police Misconduct Attorneys, and what is the intent of the Justice in Policing Act? How do you see it changing policing in the U.S.?
Well, we are a loose collection of individuals. We are not a formal organization, but we include a number of people who've handled policing cases for decades in many cases. The federal legislation that's pending calls for a lot of things, some things that are certainly very current in the conversation these days: ending chokeholds, keeping a data bank of police officers who engage in misconduct, making that national, improving training. Some of these steps we've taken here in Washington already to some extent. One important part of the bill that we're supporting very strongly is an end of qualified immunity, which has basically been the way that the Supreme Court over the past 40 years has basically allowed police officers who engage in misconduct to be unaccountable. The doctrine of qualified immunity says that if the law is not clearly developed in this context, then police officers get a pass, basically. They're not supposed to know what the law is. And increasingly, the courts have sliced this finer and finer so that there needs to be a case that is very much on point, where a high-level court has already said this exact conduct in this exact situation is improper, and that broad guidelines for police officers to use only reasonable and necessary force kind of goes by the boards.
Doesn't that notion of qualified immunity fly in the face of the 1871 Civil Rights Act, the Fourth Amendment? Am I confusing these two?
It certainly flies in the face of the 1871 Civil Rights Act, which was to make state actors, people acting under color of state law, accountable for violating people's civil rights. There was no immunity built into the original law, and this type of qualified immunity was not a doctrine at the time. It is something that the Supreme Court only started to develop in the late 1960s, and they first applied it very broadly in a case called Scheuer versus Rhodes, which is the Kent State case, where families of students who were killed at the Kent State campus sought to bring suit against Ohio officials for the National Guard using unreasonable and excessive force, shooting unarmed people on campus. And the Supreme Court said, oh, you get qualified immunity for that because people acted in good faith and these were high-level officials who made the decision. And then the doctrine has evolved since then so that officers on the street, corrections officers, all types of line officials acting under color of law employed by any governmental agency can claim qualified immunity if there's not something that's very much exactly what they are doing wrong today.
Fascinating. So, Kendrick Washington, would you say that this notion of qualified immunity has contributed, and of course, how much, to the proliferation, perhaps, of police brutality and murders of particularly people of color?
I mean, it's certainly an aspect. You know, I think people are going to be less cautious. They're going to hold to their training a little bit less if they realize that they're not going to be personally liable. You know, I think just as at fault for that also is sort of the power of police unions and the protection that they wield. You know, the combination of police unions, the combination of the thin blue line and you know, other police officers refusing to step up. And then, you know, qualified immunity is just the icing on the case, because even in the worst case scenario, most of these cops get let go and then just get picked up by some other department somewhere else. So I think it's sort of a three-headed monster.
Yeah. So Fred Diamondstone, what do you say to that? What will the police, the Act of 2020, what is it called again? I forgot the...
The Justice in Policing.
Thank you. The Justice in Policing. These people need to shorten their names. Justice in Policing Act of 2020. What hope do you have that the tenets of that act, if it is passed, will actually have an impact on reducing police brutality?
Well, I think Kendrick is right that if police officers know they are likely to be held accountable, they will be hopefully more cautious in their actions. I would also like to point out that the qualified immunity and officer liability, it's kind of an interesting situation. The original concept was, well, the officers need protection, so they're not going to be losing their homes over their misconduct. But well over 98% of police officers across the country, and certainly quite uniformly here in Washington State, officers are indemnified. All government employees are indemnified by the government. So they're not at risk anyway for losing their homes or their income, because quite typically the government is going to be responsible for satisfying the judgment. It really should be a simple matter that officers and governmental employees are held accountable if their conduct is unreasonable and unnecessary and violates the Constitution.
Could you expand on that? I need to understand. If you're saying that government employees, including police officers, are indemnified no matter what they do, does that mean that they may lose their job, but they would have essentially insurance to cover their homes and their livelihoods thereafter? Is that what that's saying?
For the conduct that they committed on the job, they would have either insurance or the government, the taxpayers, footing the bill. That
wow.
is the standard practice, both nationally, statewide, certainly in Seattle, Spokane, Tacoma, and all the counties across the state.
So I want to ask both Bailey and Janie, from a citizen's perspective, doesn't that sound like we're funding a police state? What do you think about that? Janie, I see you smiling.
Oh, because I was hoping Bailey would hop on that. It certainly does.
Bailey?
It's an interesting, it's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
Have we been funding a police state? Are we the frogs in the pot? Sitting here on the water while it boils and suddenly puts us in the midst of a police state.
Well, I mean, that's
what people are, you know, white frogs in the pot of water boiling. We're not paying a lot of attention because mostly it doesn't affect us in the same way. So I almost think we're willing frogs, if that makes any sense.
Living in denial, is that what you're saying?
Doesn't that go to the whole point of defund the police, you know, and rethink the justice system?
Yeah, what do you think about the idea of defund the police? Anyone? I'd like to hear from any one of the four of you. Just raise your hand. Yes, Kendrick.
I mean, you know, from a personal perspective in particular, I think defunding the police is probably the smart move to go. It sounds radical, and it sounds scary to those who all of us who've never known anything but sort of the police state we've lived in. But when you look at the origins of police, when you take it all the way back to the slave catching days, and you look at the increase in laws, when you look at mass incarceration, you realize very quickly that the system is not broken. The system is working actually as it was intended to work. So when we talk about reforming it, I say reforming it to what? Like, you don't take a prison and then like reform it into a schoolhouse. You tear that thing down and then you build a place for education. And it's the same idea with policing. Like, we don't have to have a model of policing necessarily that involves men who are mechanized with military equipment going up to a car to give them a ticket because their blinker was out. Every time an individual with a weapon approaches another individual, regardless of their intent, regardless of the thought that they woke up with that morning, there is always going to be a heightened opportunity for violence, a heightened opportunity for harm. And so I think that the model is wrong. I don't think people necessarily join the police force because they wake up every day thinking I'm a racist and want to hurt people. But I think there is a culture behind being given ammo and guns and tanks that breeds the problems that we have in this society.
Yes. And Fred, you had something to say about that.
Yes. I want to go back in part to some of the opening remarks that Kendrick made. I think defunding policing, if that means transforming public safety and reimagining public safety, that's very much the direction we need to go. In Washington State, in the decade of the 1990s, we doubled our prison population. And we did it because of the war on drugs. We went from a state prison population that had 6,000 offenders for non-drug crimes and 1,000 offenders for drug crimes. And by the end of the 1990s, we were about 7,000 offenders for drug crimes or drug-related crimes and 7,000 for all other crimes. And that war on drugs had much more of a devastating impact on the African-American and other minority communities in Washington State, not because white use is any less than minority use of drugs, but because of the way the laws were enforced. Our jails are currently the number one repository for people with mental illness. Half the people in jail have mental health problems. A quarter of the people in jail have serious mental health problems. Many of these folks are recycling through the jails from one low-level crime to another. We've criminalized mental illness. We've criminalized poverty. We've criminalized drug use, which is really a public health problem. And I could say more, but I think I'll bite my tongue and let others join in.
Okay. And I'm listening to you talk about the 1990s and the fact that our jails are currently filled with lots of folks who are in there for drug possession, drug offenses of one sort or another, minor offenses that really are mental health issues. I want you to put on your dream caps and tell me how you think the 1990s might have looked if our policing was more of a public safety program. Janie's thinking. Kendrick is thinking. Yes, Kendrick.
I mean, there are a lot of components that led to the explosion in the 90s. I just blanked on the name of the Crime Act bill that was so gleefully signed by, you know, our Bidens and our Clintons and, you know, and of course our politicians on the other side of the aisle as well. I think that what creates a different system is taking the criminal elements and really deciphering what is a crime worthy of incarceration, right? Like when people hear defund the police, the first thing they say is, well, good luck with that for your murderers and your rapists. Well, there's never going to be a situation in this country where we don't have a criminal force of some sort, whether we call it the police or we call it a special task force or whatever, that's going to be available to deal with the serious crimes like rape and murder. But our jails aren't filled with rapists and murderers. So I think that if the 90s would have been different, one, if the Crime Act hadn't occurred, because I think that act really penalized people particularly harshly. We all probably remember the difference between the crack and cocaine disparity that was also greatly responsible for why so many more African Americans were in jail as opposed to white Americans. But I think at core, really, the 90s wouldn't have been very much different without a completely different model of policing. The model of policing we have in this country and the way we create laws in this country has always been punitive. And until we change really our approach as a society, even because it bleeds into our schools when you look at punitive punishment, until we change our approach as a society, we're always going to have these punitive laws, and these punitive laws are going to call for the sorts of robocops that we're, you know, sort of sending out into the world to harass people.
Yeah. And what do you, I wonder too, what the impact of the three strikes you're out law, and I believe it was standard sentencing, Fred, you can probably correct me on that one. Was that a confluence of issues that then has increased the incarceration rate, not only in Washington, but throughout the United States? Fred, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, so there might be others, Bailey or Kendrick, who are better suited to answer it. But Kendrick is right. It's a punitive approach that we've taken in as a society. It goes back before the war on drugs. It certainly has many roots in the Omnibus Crime Bill and so-called Safe Streets Act of 1968. And we do need to change our culture. We do need to recognize that drug use, drug problems, mental illness are social problems or public health problems. Portugal 20 years ago had the highest drug rate in all of Europe. And Portugal 20 years ago decided that they would treat drug problems, drug crimes as mental health issues and public health issues, and basically decriminalized all kinds of drug crimes in Portugal. 20 years later, Portugal has the lowest rate of drug use in Europe, not the highest. And it's that type of public health model that we need to look at for many of our social problems.
Great idea. Bailey, you had something to say about this.
Well, you're right. Some of the issues of mass incarceration came from determinate sentencing, which started in California, I think, in around 78 or so. And I was in law school then down there and worked on some of the things that happened right after that. But then there was three strikes and you're out as well. But then also the criminal sentencing, once it became determinate sentencing, legislatures could affect everyone's sentence with the, you know, one bill could change everybody's sentences. So every year the legislature was full of whatever the crime du jour was, you know. One session it would be sex offenses and renaming them and putting higher penalties in. Another, it would be another kind of crime that was of the moment. And so sentences, once they were determinate, got ratcheted up every year by politicians who wanted to keep their reputations for being tough on crime. And that attitude that prevailed and continues to prevail really contributed significantly to the prison incarceration explosion.
To that extreme sentencing.
Not just the 90s, but before.
Yeah, to that extreme sentencing. That Kendrick, you have a comment about that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind, too, that crime was not necessarily on the rise when these new tougher laws were quote unquote coming into effect. We have a very knee-jerk reaction sort of society where one horrible thing happens and regardless of what else is happening in the world, regardless of what else the data tells us, our country responds to that, you know, that horrible thing by enacting laws. Our legislators hear the fear among people, and instead of responding to that fear with calm and with thought, they say, you know what? What's going to get my vote? I'm going to put some hard legislation in action. I mean, how many pieces of law do we have in this state and even in this country that have a victim's name attached to it, right? But when you go back and you look at that victim's name and you look at crimes during that time, that there wasn't an explosion in that sort of crime. There wasn't an uptick in crime. It was just a very unfortunate situation that happened. And with the uptick in media coverage and, you know, media becoming sort of a bloodlust ambulance chaser, you know, people began to fear walking out of their homes, even though their general neighborhoods were safe. And so we've got to get back to a space where when we're creating laws, we're doing it from an informed perspective, because all these knee-jerk reactions to what are undoubtedly horrible acts has led to, you know, the over-incarceration of so many people.
You know, that brings to mind many comments that I've heard that might compare to that Portugal example you gave us, Fred, that the United States is a teenage country, an adolescent country, and we react with those kinds of knee-jerk reactions. And of course, the media plays a big role in how people respond to criminal activity or the fear thereof. I believe I have heard, sometimes I don't remember my sources, the United States is one of the safest countries in the world. Maybe that's not true anymore. But we are the most fearful country in the world, that people are afraid to walk outside their houses. And I think the media does have a role in perpetuating those fears. I want to take a quick break here and let folks know that you are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, and at voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and we're doing a one-hour special today. I'm grateful to Captain Joe Wubbold for having relinquished his half hour to us at 12:30. And I'm grateful to Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who makes this our program and all our community information programming possible, as well as our emergency alert service. We're talking about mass incarceration, police brutality, police reform, and how all that affects Black lives in our country. Both Janie Starr, who is a Vashon Island Surge leader, and Bailey DeYoung, who is a member of Vashon's Surge Criminal Justice Group and very active in criminal justice activity, are here with us. And since we're talking about mass incarceration, there's a lot more to say about that. But I know that both of you are active in programs that are working toward decarceration. What can you tell us, Bailey, about programs that are using volunteer activity to work toward decarceration?
Well, there are actions all around the country, work that people are doing towards decarceration or abolition of the police state. And I got involved when Surge National put out a call for people who are interested in working on a task force. And so I ended up sorting myself into a phone bank. And in that phone bank, we organized Surge members to call other Surge members. We would focus on one area every time that we did it. We did it for 6 weeks, twice a week. And point them, both connect with them and find out what brought them to Surge, what was their personal connection to decarceration, and then let them know about actions that were happening either nationally or locally. And it was an education for me. I was not involved in the abolition movement, despite my heart being in that direction. I really didn't know much about it. So it was an education. And it was great to be able to connect with folks and educate them on abolition principles. And I think all of us learned a lot. And it was a perfect preface to hearing defund the police in current action. So, but that happened, that started with COVID. The motivating factor to mobilize people to take these decarceration actions was COVID and people in prison and jails and detention centers being so much at risk with the virus rampant outside and now inside. So, and there wasn't a lot of attention being paid. There still isn't enough attention being paid. So we use that moment to focus on decarceration. And I just personally had not been aware of all the actions.
Yeah, I've wondered if any of you knows whether those decarceration actions are having an impact. Are people being released from prison? Fred?
I think Bailey's raised a very important point here. I know that the King County Jail population is down approximately 30% from what it was 3 months ago. I believe that the Pierce County Jail, at least when I checked about a month ago, was also down about a third. Snohomish County is similarly down significantly, or again, at least they were a month ago. The King County jail population is consistently staying at this 30% to 32% reduced rate.
You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, and voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. We're talking about mass incarceration, police brutality, police reform, and how all that affects Black lives in our country. Both Janie Starr, who is a Vashon Island Surge leader, and Bailey DeYoung, who is a member of Vashon's Surge Criminal Justice Group and very active in criminal justice activity, are here with us. And since we're talking about mass incarceration, there's a lot more to say about that. But I know that both of you are active in programs that are working toward decarceration. What can you tell us, Bailey, about programs that are using volunteer activity to work toward decarceration?
Well, there are actions all around the country, work that people are doing towards decarceration or abolition of the police state. And I got involved when Surge National put out a call for people who are interested in working on a task force. And so I ended up sorting myself into a phone bank. And in that phone bank, we organized Surge members to call other Surge members. We would focus on one area every time that we did it. We did it for 6 weeks, twice a week. And point them, both connect with them and find out what brought them to Surge, what was their personal connection to decarceration, and then let them know about actions that were happening either nationally or locally. And it was an education for me. I was not involved in the abolition movement, despite my heart being in that direction. I really didn't know much about it. So it was an education. And it was great to be able to connect with folks and educate them on abolition principles. And I think all of us learned a lot. And it was a perfect preface to hearing defund the police in current action. So, but that happened, that started with COVID. The motivating factor to mobilize people to take these decarceration actions was COVID and people in prison and jails and detention centers being so much at risk with the virus rampant outside and now inside. So, and there wasn't a lot of attention being paid. There still isn't enough attention being paid. So we used that moment to focus on decarceration. And I just personally had not been aware of all the actions.
Yeah, I've wondered if any of you knows whether those decarceration actions are having an impact. Are people being released from prison? Fred?
I think Bailey's raised a very important point here. I know that the King County Jail population is down approximately 30% from what it was 3 months ago. I believe that the Pierce County Jail, at least when I checked about a month ago, was also down about a third. Snohomish County is similarly down significantly, or again, at least they were a month ago. The King County jail population is consistently staying at this 30% to 32% reduced rate. And it's in large part, because the county and the local courts, in response to the concerns about COVID, are saying, we don't need to lock up people who are being charged or arrested with misdemeanor crimes, at least those that aren't driving while intoxicated or domestic violence or a very few other misdemeanor crimes. We can let people who are being accused of misdemeanor crimes, shoplifting or obstruction of a police officer or other nonviolent low-level offenses, we don't need to lock them up for 60 or 90 days while they're awaiting trial. We can tell them to come back to court, at least when the courts reopen, and the crime rates are not changing. So we really should look at this moment in time as an opportunity for a conversation on how can we keep people in the community rather than in jail and protect safety. I know that the King County Executive, Dal Constantine, is very receptive to this conversation, and a lot of other King County law enforcement officials are as well. We need to get the judges, the legislators, the people in the community saying, why are we locking so damn many people up?
How do we do that? Kendrick.
Well, I mean, I think we keep having the conversations that we're having. I think Fred is exactly right. You know, when COVID began, you know, a month and a half, 2 months into this process, you know, I heard people saying, gosh, I can't wait to get back to normal. I can't wait to get back to normal. But I think in the criminal justice world, normal is unacceptable at this point. Right. I think the reduction in facilities, the population of the facilities, the reduction of youth in facilities, adults in facilities, the sort of catch and release, or, you know, giving people tickets to show up to court at a later date, has shown the sort of lie behind mass incarceration, right? This idea that we have to lock all these people up, otherwise our communities won't be safe. Well, we haven't been locking all these people up, and guess what? Our communities have been safe. So when you're confronted with something that is an absolute lie, and the numbers are there to prove it, the only choice you really should have is undoing that lie, is undoing that myth. So, you know, I know the ACLU in particular has been in contact with the governor's office. We've been in contact with state officials. And there are quite a few people that are sort of eager to use this moment to rework how we do incarceration in this state, and are recognizing that it's overdone. I mean, it costs somewhere around $140,000 a year to keep a youth in a detention facility. For $140,000 a year, you could rent them an apartment in Seattle, you could send them to UW, and you could pay for whatever sort of treatment they need surrounding, you know, the harm they, you know, allegedly done to the community. We're literally just throwing money in the trash. And with the budget shortfall that we're facing, you know, if you don't care about the morality of it all, then look at the money we're losing and think about what we could be doing with those funds.
And if some of those people get out of jail, they might keep their jobs and continue paying taxes to the
crazy.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. And Fred, you mentioned a 30% drop in King County jail occupancy. What do we know about whether Washington State prisons are letting people out? And I'm particularly concerned about those who've been incarcerated and are aging out of the system and are particularly vulnerable to COVID. What do we know about the prisons? Bailey?
They aren't letting them out. You know, the governor made a big statement after the lawsuit that Columbia Legal Services led that he was going to release 1,100 people. The last time I checked at the actual figures, it wasn't that high that he had released, and that was the end of his COVID-related releases. So they did not—they didn't release that many compared to the jail and to any jail in the state. They didn't release very many, and the testing level is abysmal. I looked last night; it was, I think, like 700 tests among the entire prison population, which I think is about 16K now and change.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That's ridiculous.
You know, I wonder, you can't tell from the press because they don't cover them. We've had our first COVID-related death that they were willing to attribute to COVID. How many other deaths have happened that were not tested? That's what I wonder.
Janie, you have a comment.
Well, I have more of a question, I guess, for the rest of you. And that has to do with Governor Inslee, who in so many ways has done, I think, a really good job in this state around COVID. And the glaring exception has been in dealing with prison populations, where it seems to me that he is tone deaf. And so I have a question, you know, we, like any activist group, we write letters, we send emails, we make comments, we do all of those things. And it doesn't seem to me that it is having an impact. So I'm curious what those of you with expertise have to say about what are we going to do about that? How do we influence him?
Kendrick?
Politics is local. You know, the governor isn't local. The governor isn't your local community. He's not your King County community. He's not Snohomish. He's not Cowlitz County, right? And so I think if we really want to start to create an influence that's going to lead up to the governor's office, I think we have to start with our local elected officials and our state reps, because, you know, from my experience, you find a much more receptive audience with them. I mean, they like the governor are also concerned with the, you know, their reelection chances, but they're certainly a lot more responsive to the community members in their individual districts.
So we have great reps, you know, and sometimes it's embarrassing to even think about writing them one more email or whatever, you know. Mostly I'm writing them thank you notes, if anything. That doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere either.
You know, that brings up, go ahead, Fred.
I was going to say, it takes a movement. And what we've been seeing on the streets has led the governor to just yesterday appoint a fairly broad ranging group of both community activists and people in law enforcement and government to step up and start talking about what kinds of proposals do we need for police change. I know that Andre Taylor, who led the I-940 effort a few years ago, is one of the people who's on that new commission. So we need to both partner with the movement. We need to hear what people in the community are saying. We need to reinforce the message and make demands on our legislators, on the governor. Is there going to be a special session in August because the state needs to respond to the budgetary issues related to COVID? Is that going to be an opportunity for those of us who want change to demand some meaningful changes now, be it ending chokeholds, be it adopting a state civil rights law so that people can sue in state court if their civil rights are violated? This is an opportunity this time to let our imaginations go.
You know, I'm thinking too, we're here to talk about mass incarceration and about police brutality. How do these two intersect, and how do you folks see the average person supporting change in both of these issues? What can we do? How do they intersect, first of all? How do you see mass incarceration and improper policing, if you will, intersecting with one another? Blank stares.
I mean, I think mass incarceration is a result of over-policing. And I think where there is over-policing, you're also going to have police brutality. Like, you've never seen someone brutalized by the police who wasn't charged with a crime, right? And, you know, even if the only crime, and you know, it's always my favorite, even if the only crime was resisting arrest, you know, they charge this person with resisting arrest. Well, what did you arrest them for to begin with? What was the crime that originated the resisting arrest charge? It's now the only charge on the sheet. I think that the moment is ripe. I think people are being awoken to the level of brutality in police forces. But I think people are also shocked by the response of the police. You have cities like Atlanta and other places where police officers are going on strike, and they're literally saying to the public, I'm going on strike because you want to hold me accountable for beating and killing and maiming people illegally. I want to be able to do those things, is what the strike is really saying. And people aren't stupid. People are seeing this and like, wait, you're going on strike because we don't want you to beat people up?
Yeah, don't we put those kids in the corner in kindergarten? Yeah, Janie.
Well, I also think it's important when we talk about people to talk about what people. And, you know, people of color, and particularly Black people, have not been surprised. Nothing is new here. This is not new information. It's that white people, Lord knows why, suddenly are waking up in greater numbers to the fact that there is targeted police brutality against people of color, particularly Black and brown people. And that, of course, that leads to greater mass incarceration. And I think we have to jump on this moment, which I'm still trying to understand myself, and expand on this moment to engage more and more white people in showing up and recognizing that when anyone is being brutalized in our country, we're all being brutalized.
Janie, so I'm so glad you brought that up.
To say people when we mean Black people.
Right. And I'm really glad you brought that up. In much of my readings, SURGE, which is Showing Up for Racial Justice, is a national organization, and it is often pointed out that it is the organization that's doing it right in white people's awareness and in teaching white people to work for the benefit of Black people. Would you please elaborate on how SURGE works and whatever else you wanted to say?
What I say is that nobody's doing it right. None of us white people are doing it right. And I think that's actually a dangerous goal because it keeps white people from taking action. We worry so much about getting it right, not offending or upsetting. And I think we need to offend and we need to upset. I think one of the things that drew me to SURGE initially, first of all, it's about showing up, which I think is really critical. But secondly, is this strong belief that we follow the lead of Black leaders, Black organizations, that we have what SURGE calls accountability partners who we team up with. For example, we're a predominantly white community on Bashan, and so we've been teaming up with individuals and organizations. I don't know, something just came with the sound.
Yeah, one of you has a phone on or a computer coming through. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Janie.
With individuals and organizations of color. This is distracting.
It is distracting. Why don't the other three of you just mute yourselves for the moment while Janie finishes her conversation?
I don't think it's me.
No, I don't think it's you. Oops. Okay.
So I might need you to refocus me a little bit.
Well, you were talking about waking up white people and the fact that we're not doing it right yet, and we need to be following the lead of people of color in working toward.
Always
go ahead.
Okay, I'm quiet.
Well, okay. Fred, I think you had something you wanted to say, and I hope you can say it over whatever other information is coming through your phone. Just unmute.
I hope I can do that.
Yeah.
I've never done Zoom on my cell phone before, so we'll see how this works. We went into a war on crime over the past 50 years, and the war on crime has just been a losing battle. I think the militarization of the police, the warrior mentality among police officers, the mass incarceration is all because of this unfortunate mentality that not only has it been a losing proposition in terms of a losing battle, a losing war, it's made us all less safe. And until we really do look at a public health model, we're going to keep having this experience. The Camden Police Department had some of the worst crime in the state of New Jersey. They had some of the worst misconduct. They had some of the lowest clearance rates. And then in Camden, about 12, 14 years ago, they decided to basically abolish the police department, lay all the police officers off, go to a countywide department. Many of the same police officers were hired back, but some weren't. For the first couple of years, the police department didn't have a union. Since then, it's had a union, but the union leadership is working in partnership with the community rather than the old warrior mentality. And it's this type of transformation and partnership that we need.
How has that affected the incarceration rate in Camden and in New Jersey?
Incarceration rate, but I know that the crime rates are significantly down.
Hmm. Well, that would affect the incarceration rate, I would think.
One would think.
Yes. I'm going to mute you.
I think
yes,
it's
Bailey.
Also just important to focus on and to remember the fact that the criminal system is designed to work the way it is in a racist way and has been since its inception. It's not neutral. It's not race neutral at all.
And I think
underpinning.
Yeah, I think Janie was working in that direction with how can white people both identify the systemic issues in our criminal justice system and what can we do to change it?
Well, in part, we've been trying to respond to what we're being asked to do. And actually, you know, I think we all get really, many of us get overwhelmed with the notion of changing systems. And so we often work with individuals. And I think that's a lot of what we have been doing locally is working in support of activist groups around decarcerating individuals who need to get out. And we've been doing that through, well, until COVID, we've been court witnessing and doing that sort of thing. And now we're more reduced to, pressuring people and sending letters of support in favor of clemency hearings and resentencing hearings. But I'd be really interested in opening that conversation around, because clearly, as Bailey said, the system is working perfectly. you go back to the 13th Amendment, you go to the documentary, which we just showed again, 13th, and we went from a slave system to an incarceration system. How we really do take that down, I think we've all been attempting to address it. But I think it's a macro and a micro issue.
Bailey, do you have some comments about that? I know you're very active also in the efforts toward decarceration.
No, I think that's true. You know, it's been gratifying to be able to do the individual support work with clemency and with resentencing hearings. But but also bigger work on the legislative level. You know, during the legislative session, we were pushing for some bills that would reform the system, not overhaul, not do it over, but also in a bigger sense, you know, there's just so much work to be done creating a new culture that looks at policing and incarceration and all the ramifications of the criminal injustice system differently, you know, and those kind of conversations we can do with our friends and our associates. And, you know, I expect that this is true for a lot of you, people that who I gather with, and our point of common interest is not related to my passion of working on this kind, on racial justice and on incarceration. And the conversations now have turned to talking about police brutality and what's going on. And all of a sudden people are much more interested in taking action. So I think that's fertile ground right now for activists, for mobilizing people. And, you know, over incarceration, mass incarceration was not a point of interest for most of my friends before COVID, but now, and because of the spotlight being shown on police brutality, people are much more inclined to take a look at the folks who are incarcerated as human beings. And isn't that the whole point, is making people realize that everybody is human, including African Americans and other people of color, or people of culture, as some refer to them? You know, you can't look at the video of Mr. Floyd's murder without saying the police officer has to be thinking he's inhuman, you know, has to be treating him as an animal.
Yeah, that was incredibly painful. Kendrick.
Yeah, I think that with mass incarceration and moving the needle, I think as has been pointed out by everyone here, we really can't ignore the underpinning that race plays in this. Mass incarceration hasn't been at the forefront of people's minds because, quite frankly, it's not a them problem. It's a Black community problem in their perspective, right? And so that also leads to, so then why are these people so disposable? Why are people in prison disposable? Because they're not like me, at least in the minds of most people. When I say the word drug dealer, most people, including most Black people, picture an African American. When I say drug kingpin, they might picture someone from another country, but someone who is Latinx. And so I think that the only way this is going to change is that we have to keep beating the drum, and we have to keep linking the race to this, because racism isn't going to go away through policy change. Racism isn't going to go away through laws. Racism is defeated by intentionality. People have to have intentionality in their desire to change. And as Michelle Alexander, you know, said in the New Jim Crow about 7 years ago, felon has ostensibly replaced the N-word, right? And so whereas you couldn't, you know, whereas now you would never say, I'm not going to have that N-word at my home for dinner, or I won't let that N-word marry my daughter, or I won't hire that N-word. Almost everyone you meet is still comfortable saying, I won't hire that felon. I won't let that felon date my daughter. I'm not bringing a felon into my home. And so we have to educate people and disabuse them of the notion that, one, African-Americans are criminals, and two, that regardless of whether you're African-American or not, if you're a criminal, that you're not, that somehow you're instantly redeemable, that you are the worst thing that you've ever done. And I think until we can start disabusing Americans of that, we're going to continue along this path. And finally, I would just say that with the issue of race, we have to also remember that, like, jail serves a purpose for many white people in various parts of the country. You know, it keeps Black people off their streets, but it also keeps them from the voting booth. Right. And we can't ignore, particularly in places like the South, that incarceration has been used to disenfranchise people. It's been used as a means to keep, you know, a certain class of individuals in power. And that can't be ignored, because power does not cede itself peacefully. So, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. We got to buckle up and settle in. This isn't going to go away after a couple of weeks of protests and people putting up a few Black screens on their social media.
Kendrick. Oh, yes, Janie.
Well, it brings up two things for me. One is we've been working already on Get Out the Vote. And over this weekend, I had the privilege of working with a group called Black Pack, which was focused on encouraging, I don't know how they get the list, but encouraging predominantly African-Americans in particular states such as Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, key states to commit to voting. And I think that that is something that is really critical that everybody can be working on. It was interesting because this was run by African Americans, and I asked the question that Bailey had asked of me, which was, is it okay for white people to be texting African Americans around this issue, or shouldn't we be texting white people? And so I asked the leader, and he's like, you know, we don't care what color your thumb is. We want anybody texting. Now, if you start telling us which way we should go in the march or demonstration, we're not going to be following your lead. And I found that particularly helpful. The other thing I just wanted to say is I think that people respond to stories, and it's one of the ways that we humanize folks. And something that we're working on right now with a group of food justice folks on the island is a GoFundMe campaign for a man named Lawrence Jenkins, who is incarcerated in Washington State. And we're trying to raise $15,000 so that he can pay his attorney for clemency hearing. And he is an African-American man who has become a hero in the food justice movement. He's actually growing food while incarcerated to feed people in food banks in the neighborhood of that prison, Stafford Creek. I don't think he should be extraordinary in order to get a clemency hearing, but that is something that people respond to. So that's my pitch.
Thank you. We're down to 2 minutes, and I want to direct our listeners to Voice of Vashon /Real Talk. There is an interview there with Lawrence Jenkins and his wife, Alita Haskins, about his resentencing. And one of the things that happens in these conversations is that we don't necessarily make sure that people who are listening hear about the organizations they can partner with or become involved with in order to move the needle on, in this case, mass incarceration and police brutality. So I want to mention the folks who are represented here. Kendrick Washington is with Washington State's American Civil Liberties Union, better known as the ACLU, and they have a program called ACLU's Smart Justice Program. And if you go to their website, Kendrick, I hope I'm saying this right, you can find out how to be involved and what exactly the goal of that program is. That's great. Also represented here by Janie Starr and Bailey DeYoung is Showing Up for Racial Justice. That's Surge. They have a website. So does the ACLU. If you just Google these organizations, you can find them. Another one is the Freedom Project Seattle, which is involved with decarceration efforts and helping people who are coming out of incarceration. And Bailey, I believe you have done some work with the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites. Am I right about that? C-A-R-W?
I haven't actually done any work, but I use their website and their newsletters. That's the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites. It's basically the Surge chapter in Seattle.
Okay, and we have 1 minute left.
Since 2001 and have a great depth of resource.
Thank you. And then Janie mentioned Black Pack.
Yes, I would also, though, locally mention the Northwest Bail Fund. We haven't really spent any time talking about bail, but I think that's
yeah,
critical.
That's a big one.
And then I would also mention NERP, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, which has been working hand in hand with the ACLU on all kinds of critical legislative issues. And yes.
I want to thank all four of you. We have run out of time. You've been listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday to explore issues from every angle I can get. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Janie Starr from Vashon Surge, for joining us. Kendrick Washington from Washington State ACLU. Fred Diamondstone, activist, lawyer for the Justice in Policing Act of 2020. Talk to your legislators. And Bailey DeYoung, another island activist for criminal justice. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to hear on The Voice of Vashon.